He's a world-renowned zombie scholar, professor of zombies and popular media, and co-author of the book Zombie Mania, one of the first exhaustive guides to zombie cinema. He's Dr. Arnold T. Blumberg, the Doctor of the Dead.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
Well, hey, everybody, and welcome back to episode 96 of the Doctor of the Dead podcast. We will be talking about the latest episode of Z Nation, which was called A New Mission, Keep Moving. A reference back, actually, to the season 3 episode, A New Mission, from almost exactly a year ago. But first up, we wanted to mark the passing of filmmaker Umberto Lenzi, who many zombie fans know. He was one of the true schlockmeisters and exploitation filmmakers of his day. I don't think many people would necessarily say that he was at the heights of filmmaking like many grand creators, but the point is not that. The point is that Lenzi's work was very memorable, and a great many fans in the horror community, especially in the world of subgenres like zombies and giallo films and the cannibal films, remember Lenzi's work quite a bit. Movies like Eaten Alive and Cannibal Ferox, and two films that I covered in Zombie Mania with my co-author Andy Hirschberger many years ago. One was called Black Demons from the 90s, and it had some fascinating mix of voodoo and other zombie stuff in it. But to pay tribute to Umberto Lenzi, we decided to take a look at the movie most people, particularly zombie fans, know well, Nightmare City, otherwise known as City of the Walking Dead. If you encountered it at a video store in the 80s, you probably saw it with City of the Walking Dead. It also had a few other titles, like so many of these movies do, including Invasion by the Atomic Zombies. But most people today know it as Nightmare City, and it's Lenzi's zombie opus, which he spent the rest of his career and life denying was a zombie movie, shades of Danny Boyle in 28 Days Later. He insisted that Nightmare City, they were radiation victims and not zombies at all, but we get to make that call, and Nightmare City has since gone on to become, if not necessarily a well-loved, certainly a very well-remembered zombie film from the boom period post-Dawn of the Dead in the early 1980s, and it shows a lot of hallmarks of having been influenced by everything from Romero to Fulci to lots of other stuff. Now, Natalie hadn't seen Nightmare City at all, And so we popped it on, and it had been a long time since I'd seen it. And since we've been reviewing a lot of more recent and some classic films, this was, to pay tribute to Lenzi, a perfect opportunity to go back to Nightmare City.
Just like a Western.
Except that they didn't have instant coffee in the good old days. Another advantage of civilization, my dear. Like Coca-Cola or nuclear energy, we'd be a whole lot healthier without all that stuff.
This is good.
Well, this was exactly what I was expecting from a Spanish-Italian collaboration of its time. So unlike last week, this week I was presented with basically all the checkboxes for this type of film. Just bright, bright red, like tempura paint blood.
Right.
A lot of tits just everywhere.
Yes.
And a very graphic eye wound. One of those eye wounds where you kind of lean into it so they can make sure that they get the shot right and get the eye.
She didn't really seem like put out by it or in pain so much as really like just surprised at this happening and decided she would lean into it a little bit.
Well, she's very accommodating. It's one of those, oh, the eye, you just want the eye? Yeah, well, that's fine. Maybe if I just kind of lean into that and you take the eye and I've got the other one, so I'll just skedaddle out of here. So, yeah, it ticked all those boxes for me. Not, I guess, in a, I would call this a classic kind of way, but also I'm coming to it kind of late in the game.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really one of the things about it is that Nightmare City, like I said, it does seem to be very well remembered. It's one of the ones that will frequently come up on lists. And, you know, if people are putting together a rundown of zombie film history, they will surely include Nightmare City. And again, it's fun how this links back to our ongoing conversation, in that Boyle in 28 Days Later continues to inspire debate that he himself encouraged, because people are like, well, they don't qualify as zombies, and we've been through all that. Yes, they do, and they are. But the same thing with Lindsay in Nightmare City. And Lindsay was specifically told, make a zombie movie, because of, you know, what was going on at the time, and to market a zombie film. He decided to try to do something a little different. He was inspired by a recent nuclear accident, or rather it was a poison gas accident that had happened at the time. And it was called the Italian Chernobyl. And used that as the basis for his Radiation Victims, which are basically frenetic madmen stabbing women in the breasts and drinking their blood and looking like they've had caked Rice Krispies and green stuff put on their faces, and occasionally like missing spots because, of course, you know, the makeup is horrible. And he decided he did not make a zombie movie. But again, you know, that's not his determination to make. They're most definitely zombies. They are very akin to 28 Days Later in certain ways. They have the frenetic quality, the rage driving them. And in this case, there's some interesting pathology differences. The radiation supposedly has enhanced them, made them more than human, more powerful. In a way, it was a neat way to sidestep the fact that they're not dead and therefore immune to injury by making them alive but immune to injury, because they're supposedly so much enhanced that only a shot to the head could take them out. So he really just created another version.
What I find interesting about it in that sense, and in terms of the pathology of everything, is if this were a movie being made now, the entire role of the government entity in it would be completely different. It's mm-hmm. like right now in this one, the military is kind of just being the military. They're being secretive. They don't want people to know what's going on. They're trying to just control the situation so they don't incite a mass panic, that kind of thing. If this were happening now, as soon as the military doctor makes that claim that they are super powered in terms of their healing ability, that the body is healing itself as it's attacked, I guarantee you there's someone higher up who's trying to contain the area rather than destroy the area so they can harness that power for science.
That's
right.
I mean,
there's somebody medically. I guess maybe you could say that's kind of the evolution it took with the Resident Evil series.
Yes. Yeah.
The idea of the T-virus being something where if it bonds with you properly, then you're still in control of your faculties, but you're super powered, you can jump higher, you can run faster.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing where if this were being made now, I think that would be the third act. The third act would be you'd find out that this was done on purpose, that they were trying to see if it works, this was a test case,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of thing. But instead, it just kind of peters out.
It would be worth noting, too, we don't know quite what's going to happen now, but for many years now, there's been a project being run to do a big, not necessarily big budget, but bigger budget, I imagine, remake of Nightmare City. They've gone through, I believe, Indiegogo, Kickstarter, something like that. They attached Tom Savini to direct it, but Savini's been attached to direct many things over the years that have never come to fruition. And that team that's been working on the Nightmare City remake several years ago contacted me and included me in some of their initial promotion. I even did a little video promotion for their fundraising campaign to help promote it. I haven't actually heard directly from them in a little while. They're based in Germany. And they recently reacted to the death of Lindsay with shock. Doesn't affect their rights or their production at all, but it also doesn't seem like it's coming along very quickly, so it's hard to say what will happen, but they've been trying to make a new one, and it would be interesting if that ever finally happens, if it does something similar to what you're saying, because it's like the potential is there for a slightly more interesting version of this otherwise just gore-fest kind of story that Nightmare City is. It's not much to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe if you cross the original film with, say, a Dean Koontz novel,
mm-hmm.
where there's some kind of weird underground secret government experimentation going on, and so they unleash it in a small town so that they can see what happens, which is about 80% of all Dean Koontz novels.
Uh-huh.
Which, I mean, no disrespect, I love Dean Koontz, so go for it. But it would be interesting to find out that it was not an accident. That they tell people on the news, oh, there was some kind of accident at the plant and it released radiation. And that's the story for 90% of the other people in the country who just see it and think, oh, it's too bad. They had to shut that down. They had to, there was a contamination. Actually, now I'm just describing Resident Evil now that I think about it.
Right.
So what happens is the story opens in Raccoon City.
Okay. Otherwise known as Nightmare City.
Yeah.
Well, I'll throw out a few other things about this. This movie also features as the more or less star of the film, someone that I believe Andy had written the review for this in Zombie Mania, and I love it. What he described as a vortex of charisma. Hugo Stiglitz, the man that Quentin Tarantino was inspired to use his name for a character in Inglourious Basterds. And Tarantino has been on record as saying he likes Nightmare City Zombies the best, so we know where his aesthetics lie. But Stiglitz is so passive through the entire movie. He just moves through the entire process with his fluffy hair and his beard and his wife. His wife, who is extremely intelligent, is a doctor who provides all of the film's thematic content, including long diatribes. I mean, nicely done ones, but long diatribes on the nature of humanity, the future of our world. You yourself pointed out it echoes the dinner table argument in 28 Days Later, you know.
Yeah, she has that philosophical bent to it, saying, you know, as a doctor, as a scientist, she can see that this is what happens when you try to interfere with nature, and man has done something that has interfered, and this is the reset button, which also harkens back to the idea behind The Happening, too, when we were talking about last week.
It's amazing how all this fits together, and she has a line at one point which says, we're up against a race of monsters, which are created by other monsters, which are us. There's that shot that at one point is hysterically funny, where they fly over, I think, in helicopter, and they just see all of them running around on the field, like, in different directions. But in a way, it's also just the perfect summing up of what the movie's all about, which is, we're all nuts, and we're all destroying each other, and that's it. So there's something to it. It's just that the movie is ultimately your basic grindhouse excursion into nudity and violence and how much of that they can get to. And frankly, if you were a fan of this kind of thing in the 80s and you went to the video store and you rented City of the Walking Dead, you got exactly what you wanted. The movie doesn't make you wait more than 5 minutes at any stretch before there's some other kind of mayhem going on. And that's pretty much what the movie was for.
And I will say, I mean, in terms of watching a gore fest that, mm-hmm. you know, you're tuning in intentionally. This is a gore fest that also does have a plot, which is nice.
Yeah, it carries you through.
It's sort of a central theme. The creatures behave consistently mm-hmm. throughout. I like the idea that they are, I mean, I guess much more the classic interpretation, really, of a zombie. They're sort of this, like, carrier, this, like, puppet for whatever radiation is moving through their system, which is trying to survive by making them extremely survivable. Mm-hmm. That you can't take them down. They still are using tools. They're shooting guns, which is insane.
Yeah, they're fully functional but otherwise mute, but fully functional human beings that are actually using tools and weaponry and behaving less like the depersonalized monsters we're used to and more like, well, just generally crazy people, you know, and they're carrying that, and every injury they create leads to another creature.
Not only that, they're intentionally moving in groups.
Yeah.
They're working together.
They strategize.
I mean, there is something to be said for the fact that whatever is superpowering all of their faculties, giving them strength, giving them healing ability, is also supercharging the brain so that they can do whatever it is that they need to do. I mean, there's some who are driving a car at one point, like the friends who drive up to the campsite, and they've already been infected, but they're driving.
And they also don't look nearly as far gone as some of them, too. So they're, mm-hmm. like, in an early stages, you can completely fool a victim in the sense that you don't look immediately like the Rice Krispie, you know, burned look that the full cases have.
Mm-hmm.
You can be, like, just look like a crazy person. and you could take, you know, friends by surprise, which is what a few of them do. You mentioned radiation. I know that we mentioned, I love, there are a few thing little touches about this. It's not the greatest movie in the world, certainly. But like we said, it has some interesting ideas in it. It has the potential for being better if those ideas had been explored. There are a few other things that leapt out at the time. We just noted comically that the military meet to discuss this whole thing and talk about how these are like lethally irradiated creatures and then just wheel one of them into the room and stand around with it. It's like radiation doesn't stop. So,
and they stop just short of everybody walking up to it and poking it with their fingers. They're all just leaning over.
It's just crazy.
And like huffing the cadaver radiation fumes. But nothing happens to them. Nope. And even later on, somebody goes out on a mission and he says, you know, how's he doing? And they're like, oh, no, he made it like, you know, 20 miles out or something. And here's his body. And they like take the sheet off of it. And there he is, all dead. And I'm like, well, maybe you should stop wheeling in the the dead radioactive people.
That would be a good idea.
To leave them outside.
I do like the fact that the radiation victims, zombies, are all so consistently neat that every time they drink the blood of a victim, they all seem to wipe their mouths afterward. They're very weirdly mannered for, you know, frenetic radiation victims. They just go after dance studio groups and people alone in houses. But then when it's time to eat, they like to be neat. You know,
it gives it, and I doubt this was really the intent, but for me anyway, it gives it a little touch of humanity again.
Yeah.
It's like they're driven by this urge to feed, which I think the military doctor explains as whatever the radiation's doing to their bodies is depleting their red blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they have to go after blood, because they have to replenish that.
And it adds the vampiric angle to it that we see in a lot of like zombie vampire hybrid characters.
Mm-hmm. But they're driven by this feeding urge, which is very animalistic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just pure hunger and pure rage. But then after they get it, in that moment, right after they replenish those red blood cells, it's like it gives them just a tiny little reprieve where they have the humanity in there.
That's a nice idea. And I also kind of like the idea of linking it a little bit to Return of the Living Dead, where we find out they're eating the brains to ease the pain of being dead. Maybe the drinking of the blood of this gives them a little clarity.
Yeah.
When they're doing that, yeah. And I'd even point out, although I don't like them, the Marvel Zombies characters, when they eat, get back their original personality and humanity for a little while, like a little clarity. So, and there are other characters. iZombie does a variation of that. There are other zombie characters where the feeding gives them a chance to clear their mind a little bit. So that makes sense.
They do that in Warm Bodies
as well.
Warm Bodies, when a zombie eats a brain, they experience the memories of the person.
Yeah, like iZombie too.
Yeah, yeah. She kind of takes on the abilities. It's like she gets the memories,
yes,
but also takes on the traits.
Yes.
And it's like Warm Bodies, it's sort of one of those, I'm no longer human, but I can experience what it was to be human.
The difference is no one is going to start a romantic relationship with a radiation victim from Nightmare City.
No, I don't think so.
They're terrible looking. But a couple of things to add in. I love the moment. It's still one of my favorite moments. We watched the Italian version of the film, which is the only way you really should, with subtitles. If you're watching a foreign movie, stop it with the dubbing. Although, if you've already seen it, you could watch the dubbed version of something for the added fun. But way back when we did Zombie Mania, we didn't have access to a subtitled version. So we only had a dubbed version. And there's a scene where they stop in a little snack bar place and Stiglitz has his coffee and just looks up with the utter lack of expression he has through most of the film and just looks at her and says, this is good. And when we watch this one, he's a little more expressive in his actual line delivery than the dub sound. So it kind of ruins that line, because I love how just seemingly utterly disaffected he is in that moment. But
to be fair, he's barely more expressive.
Yes.
In Italian.
Yeah, that's true. A few other things I wanted to mention in terms of connections. This movie has an amusement park finale on a roller coaster, and we just covered a similar thing in Zombieland. You think that there's a strong possibility that the City of the Walking Dead logo may have been at least partly an inspiration for Robert Kirkman to go with the Walking Dead.
I think so, because when we were talking about it and you showed me the VHS box or a film poster or whatever with the City of the Walking Dead logo, I looked at the font on it and the way that the letters were kerned, and I thought, well, that looks a heck of a lot like the Walking Dead comic logo.
Yes,
I mean, the
yes.
one that's on the comic. And I pulled them up side by side, and it's certainly not exact. It's not like you'd say, oh yeah, that's totally it.
But you never know. Some could
But I looked at it and I thought, surely he had to have seen that video box.
I'm sure.
And when he decided on the phrase Walking Dead, for whatever reasons he did with that, I think it was somehow imprinted on him. It had to be, because it
could very well have been.
Or it could not be. Who knows? Maybe whenever you decide to artistically put out the words Walking Dead, somehow you just naturally scooch the letters around a little bit. It's
right.
It's the human experience.
And as far as other things to mention about Nightmare City, I'll just point out, a little disjointed here, but that's all right, is that there's the scene in the church is also yet another example of a perfect moment in an exploitation film. The idea that, okay, we need to be transgressive here. We've got nudity, we've got violence, we've got tempura paint everywhere, and let's also have a priest become something and kill him in the church, because there's no, you know, shelter, there's no God here, there's no protection spiritually. And it fits in with some of the moments in the movie where it almost feels like it's trying to make a statement but isn't quite good enough to do it as well as it could. But it's there. And maybe it's those little glimmers that made this movie stand the test of time for so many zombie fans.
And you have that moment as well in 28 Days Later, which we were just talking about last week, where, I mean, Jim's wandering around the streets for ages and can't figure out what to do, and sees a church, and suddenly that's the building he goes into and walks around, and the person who comes after him is the priest.
And it just shows that even if we can't know for certain whether it's the Walking Dead phrase or the church scene or the amusement park or any number of other things in this movie, for all the reasons why this movie is ultimately something where you could say, well, this is kind of a forgettable exploitation piece, it's also a movie that quite clearly, whether consciously or not, ingrained itself in the minds of a lot of fans of zombies and horror. And it is important. It is a movie that really set, maybe not certain standards, but set up certain ideas that would then echo forward even as far as the most recent episode of Z Nation, because we were watching that and then we watched Nightmare City for this episode and discovered that both of them feature a similar sequence in which a number of zombies are tricked into the vicinity of a car rigged to explode, and then the explosion takes them out. So as far as 2017, Nightmare City from 1980 is still affecting people. And I will mention one last thing about it, which is that if anything is memorable from the movie, it's the moment that certainly threw you for a loop, I think, which was the real cop-out ending, partly inspired at least by classics like Invaders from Mars, in which you get caught in the loop of, oh, it's all a dream, and then the whole thing starts over again. Which I've never been able to 100% figure out why bother doing that, except maybe it's like, oh, we're trapped in purgatory, it's never going to end.
And that's one of those things, too, where they just used the footage over again.
Yes.
So yeah. To me, it felt like they said, okay, this movie has to be X number of minutes long, and they were like 5 minutes short, and they were like, whoop, we're just going to use this footage over again. But to me, the easiest way to make that impactful and to actually have like a message to drive through is that you play it through right up to the point of the doors about to open on the plane, and then he turns to the camera guy and says something along the lines of, wait, something's not right here.
Oh, you'd really want to underscore the idea that this is a cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, make it a cycle or don't make it a cycle. Don't, like, take me back to the plane. And then roll credits.
Yeah, which is exactly what it does. And it also has an infectious, catchy title tune that fits in that era of the synthesized zombie music that everybody's familiar with. We'll be right back. But I don't have anything else to say about it except that it's one of those ones that sticks in the mind. Very often you could say, like we already have a few times here, it's certainly not an excellent example of zombie storytelling. And yet it's one that, particularly for people at the time that saw them, and especially for all those who were mining the shelves of the video stores in the 80s and picking up Fulci and Argento and all the European stuff that we were all fascinated by because it was just so different and so wrong in so many ways. Nightmare City was one of those movies. And so it stands the test of time mainly because it's visually memorable. It has just some absolutely insane, goofy stuff. The attack on the dance studio thing is something everybody remembers. There's a lot of stuff like that in this, and it's not going to win any awards. But if for no other reason than the connections to things after it, as we just pointed out, it also had an effect. And so if for just that reason, Umberto Lenzi left some things behind that will certainly last long after he's gone, and fans will remember that he created some stuff that people can continue to enjoy.
And I will say, as sort of a capper for me, if you're watching this now for the first time with either, I don't know, what I'd call modern sensibilities, or just being a woman in general, you will have to steel yourself for being a bit offended that somehow zombies understand that you can drink a man's blood from the neck, but you've got to drink a woman's blood from the whole cleavage region, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a bit much for me. But it's also of a time, and it's of a style in that sense. And there are some movies where I've watched them and I've said, nope, there is nothing redeeming about this. It's just exploitation. This is not one of those.
That's interesting, at least. Yeah.
I mean, this is one of those where it has its exploitative qualities. And I knew that going in. So it was not one of those things where I'm watching it and the whole time going, oh, come on, really? Mm-hmm. Must you again with the, oh, yep, there we go. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a bit where it's like they attack a hospital and one of the zombies rips open a nurse's uniform and somehow she showed up for a 12-hour shift with no underwear on. Mm-hmm. And you think, I just don't know that that's something that would happen in real life. But also, I don't know. I mean, it was the 70s and
yeah.
People did
and they're Italian,
goofy things.
Yeah. Or Spanish.
Maybe it's just a European, you know, no bra nursing lifestyle, mm-hmm. but
it might have been no bra Friday for all we know.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right, I take back everything. It was no bra Friday, and that's just what happens. But it wasn't offensive in that sense. It's like I knew it was coming, and it is not like if somebody made a movie now,
yes,
and did that. Yeah, and also, I mean, there's no excuse for it then
right.
either. It's sort of like, I'm not going to say, well, it was, you know, when it was, and they were Italian, and there's going to be a lot of women.
Well, you did kind of just say that, though.
Yeah.
You said it was of a time.
It know. Is of a time, but that's not saying
that. You're not excusing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not me saying it's okay that he did that.
Right, right.
It's me saying, I will factor that into my consideration when I'm sort of assessing the merits of the film. It does have its interesting points, and it does create a really interesting pathology that I like. So I think that there are elements of it that help redeem the sort of unsavory bits for me.
Just a quick little addendum to our Nightmare City conversation. We went through that entire thing, and not once did I mention one of the most obvious reasons why Nightmare City is important in the history of zombie film. It's long been regarded as one of the first, if not the first, to really focus on a zombie creature that runs rather than just shambling. And obviously that's a bit more complicated. The Cemetery Ghoul in Night of the Living Dead moves along at a pretty fast clip sometimes. There are other examples throughout zombie film history. And after Nightmare City, of course, most people thought 28 Days Later was earth-shattering for presenting running zombies. I always point people to Nightmare City. And of course, Return of the Living Dead also featured it. But in that whole conversation, I can't believe I'd forgotten to mention that. So I just decided to drop that in right here. This week, Z Nation was titled A New Mission, Keep Moving. And in this one, we go to the Great Pile, which is just a huge, huge car lot that gives The Highway and The Walking Dead in Season 2 a run for its money. This episode was directed by the Murphy himself, Keith Allen. And it was an interesting episode that basically, I felt on the one hand, it felt a little bit like what you'd call a bottle episode, where you set all of the stuff in like one set, except of course that by putting it in an expansive environment like the all the, you know, stalled cars, all the old cars, it felt a lot more open and interesting than that. But it still definitely felt like, well, let's impose a limitation. Mm-hmm. And then see what happens. And of course, during the course of this episode, for all intents and purposes, plot-wise, the only real main issue in this episode is, will this team continue to follow Warren with her increasingly squirrely, prophecy dream-driven, you know, mission, or will they head to Numerica? And they seem to be shifting their allegiance to one idea or the other every 5 minutes, but at the end of this, it's pretty predictable, really, that everybody was going to wind up back on Warren's side again, because she is our center point, and always has been, even when she's crazy.
And it does sound to me like Warren herself is a little distressed about the fact that she's following a vision instead of an order or a plan, and that the vision is not consistent, that she'll have these moments of clarity where quite literally she sees the path laid out before her, and then there are moments where she completely loses track of where it is she wants to go. It's not like she can set her compass to a certain coordinate and say, this is where we're headed. She doesn't know. And I think that bothers her too, but she's not willing to let go of whatever it is inside of her that is insisting that this is real and this is what she needs to do.
And we do get that intervention scene where Murphy and the others decide to sit her down. It's like, come on now, we've got to figure out what this is about. And, you know, are you leading us astray? And I will say, it's also part and parcel of one of the things about this episode that I'll say I found interesting, which is that Keith directed it, and it very much puts Murphy front and center. There are two ways to go with when you're directing an episode. Either you step back quite a bit because you have to balance the work, or you take it as an opportunity to really give yourself a focus and use that in a way to help shape the performance. And we've seen it in many other shows many different ways. In this, however, he really took on the double duty of directing and giving himself quite a bit to do. Well, I mean, he didn't write it, but was it Delandre?
Delandre, yeah.
And they wrote Rise of the Zombies together for Asylum and other things. But also, it still does continue an element to this that I'm finding intriguing and not sure where it's going, in that the Murphy we're seeing in this season so far just feels so drastically different from where we left him. And yes, I know, once again, we got the 2-year gap. We got everything that happened at Zona. He's supposedly cured, although there was a truly creepy scene at the end of this episode where he's not only tasting his blood, but starting to eat his own flesh. So I think my prediction from a few episodes back may be right, that he's going to backslide back into some form of zombification. But with his floppy hair now and his Zorro-like sword tactics, he very much put himself right in swashbuckler mode in this one. And that's quite a bit far from where he was as Mussolini last year.
Yeah, also all while wearing his, like, casual Friday, we're all gonna go to the squash court after work Zona outfit. The, like, branded Zona zip-up track jacket or whatever it is that he sort of had, the little sweater lit.
When escaping Zona, make sure you pick up some fine souvenirs and,
Yeah, they didn't bring any luggage with them when they left, so I guess he was just always layering underneath, and so when they got out,
he just had his Zona shirt on.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of funny stuff in this one also that makes it distinctly Z Nation. It's that attitude that makes this show so much fun. And there were a lot of them in this. There was a nice callback to the Grand Canyon in this one. There's Doc's inner monologue at the beginning. In fact, a lot of nice Doc moments, like his line where he said, "Ah, it's the old, woke up from a coma, now I'm psychic thing," did that.
They got him back in his little hippie sunglasses with, like, the scarf around his head rolled up. It was nice, and I do love having that Doc 10K interplay.
Oh, and 10K popping in from the window at the top of the trailer to come
I think that was maybe my favorite little moment from the whole episode, because it finally felt to me like, it's sort of like you've been saying, of you're not sure what's going on with Murphy and this character development. And to me, 10K is like returning to his old self.
Yes.
And I love that.
Oh, and we also did get a moment that made me feel a little better, where it's very clear that he really still can't stand Murphy and shouldn't. And I just felt that the initial reunion lacked a little resonance that could have been an important beat, but I like the fact that this made that clearer again.
And they have the interplay between Murphy and Lucy, where it's sort of like I was anticipating from last week when we were talking about it, where Lucy now represents the sort of new humanity, and she can communicate with the zombies, she knows their names, she even goes as far as saying she's scared, that she knows that they're feeling still, even in the state that they're in.
And that is truly, truly disturbing, to have a situation where you know no matter how monstrous, animalistic, dangerous zombies are, that if they are remotely capable of communicating on any level to another being about their names and their sense of emotion, then that means they're a person still.
They've retained their humanity underneath of all of that.
Yeah, and there's no, you once you know that that's true, and assuming everything Lucy says is true, and let's assume we can trust her, that her feelings are accurate, then that means there's no denying the fact that although they are a threat to the people we perceive as heroes in the show, the zombies are beings that deserve to exist. In some sense, that makes them a lot less than just the mindless hordes. And that's really disturbing. And that's why, like I was saying, I missed the stuff about Murphy in the past, sort of being the advocate for the zombies. And Lucy has very much taken that role, especially in this episode. And I found her a bit insufferable at times about it, when she was quite literally endangering everyone's life, like the car explosion thing we mentioned in the first segment. But if she's perceiving these things correctly, she has a good reason.
And you also have to remember that she's basically like a 3-4-year-old teenager.
Mm-hmm.
So she represents, I guess, all emotion when it comes to this. Like, to her, there's no room for thinking it through. She's just going to feel. And whatever she feels, that's what she's going to do. And it's interesting because that is, to a certain extent, what Murphy was like even as an adult. It's like, is this something that is just because she's a teenager, or is this something that's because she is Murphy's offspring, and right, so she's going to have some of his wild streak in her?
And I also mentioned the fact that with Lucy's perception of the Z's and their personas still being there, their personalities still being present, she mentions that the mad Z's, the ones that are all but indestructible now, those are the ones that are just screaming inside, and she can't control them at all. But that also indicates that of all the Z's out there, the only ones that could truly be considered to be monsters are the mad Z's, the ones that have gone so far. But that still leaves an enormous amount. I'm fascinated, actually, by this idea, the more we talk about it. That leaves the vast hordes of them out there as beings that are, in some sense, inside, still people. And it's one of the recurring themes in any zombie story that have always been fascinating, whether it's Romero's exploration of identity in zombies like Bub or Big Daddy, to recent shows like iZombie, or to things in The Walking Dead. Remember early in The Walking Dead, whether it was Morgan's wife or the little girl zombie in the first episode, they had originally intended that there would be a little more indication that perhaps they were retaining memory and behavior. But they decided to drop that, probably wisely, because the way to facilitate their kind of story was to say, no, these zombies just need to be destroyed. Otherwise, you couldn't have done stories like the one later with Lizzie, where she's crazy because she's trying to treat them like beings. Now, with this one in Z Nation, one of the many interesting things this show has done is we now I mean, kind of with Murphy we already knew, but with Lucy now, we know for certain that these creatures are not completely mindless. And that's a huge moral dilemma, I think.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I had brought up warm bodies earlier, and that's a concept that they look at in warm bodies as well, that there are, at least in that world, two different tiers of zombies.
Right.
There are the zombies who are shuffling around, but they still are essentially retaining a bit of their humanity. They're the ones that eat the brains, they experience the memories, and they kind of communicate loosely with each other. They still continue to mill around and do things that they did when they were human. And then they have what they call the bonies, which are people who are too far gone. They've lost all their sense of humanity and, in a certain sense, all of their hope. And they actually just, like, eat their own bodies down to the point where they're skeletal, and they will just come after anyone and anything, other zombies, humans, doesn't matter.
Right.
And the fact that they have a system wherein there's different tiers of zombie, and it sounds like not for the same reason. It's like a sort of a warm bodies universe. It's all keyed in to how much hope you have and how much you've retained your own humanity. I think with the Madsies, it looks more like this is just a straight up mutation.
Yeah.
But it still does create that same tiered system. And also because Lucy can communicate, it creates the possibility for her essentially leading an army of zombies. I mean, she could communicate enough with these zombies to have them fight back against the Madsies and create a distraction, because they're gonna run out of ammo. It's like they're emptying entire clips into a single Madsie, and this is a situation where you're going to run out of supplies eventually. And at this point in the apocalypse, I'm surprised they haven't already, quite frankly.
Some other interesting things about this episode of Z Nation that I liked was nods to other things. Recently in the show, there had been a what felt like a kind of an overt Saving Private Ryan reference to the scene where Tom Sizemore was bleeding out. By the way, just a little note, I tweeted that at the time that episode was airing, and Tom Sizemore liked the tweet, so there we go. I could fill in another block on my Twitter bingo card, apparently. So that was recently, what was that? Recently it was Mark Hamill, Jennifer Tilly, and Tom Sizemore now. That's got to be some kind of thing. I don't know what.
the triumvirate.
Yeah, I guess so, right? Because they're so similar.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, there was another kind of Saving Private Ryan nod a little bit. Not that that's the only one that ever did this, where they had the explosion and everybody wanders around, you know, deaf for a little bit. But the rat, we got to talk about the rat Z's. Or Z-Rat, which they capped off beautifully at the end of the episode by revealing it was an Ender, one of the human beings who've sort of gone around the bend and become zombie-like of their own accord, sort of, who was using a rat puppet. And thankfully, because that was not convincing at all, and yet the characters seemed to think they were facing actual rat Z's, and they weren't. But as soon as that came up, I thought, hey, this reminds me of the Sumatran rat monkey from Peter Jackson's Brain Dead or Dead Alive. So it was kind of a nice touch there a little bit. Although that stop motion rat monkey was already more convincing than the Ender's rat puppet.
I do also love that it turned out it was a one-man puppet show.
Yeah.
Who was just covered in them. And the fact that he'd even taken the time to make them,
yes,
is pretty incredible. Or was he a guy who had a one-man rat puppet show before the apocalypse, and now he's just,
that could be,
playing that out? I mean, I won't count out anything at
That's
this
true.
Point. But it was nice because I think both of us were looking at it and thinking, this is,
yeah,
this looks a little bit like a puppet. And then it turns out it's a puppet.
It's a
and you're
puppet.
Like, all right, you got me. That's a good one.
Yeah, I like that. And then we did get finally some indication of when we might, well, maybe not when we might see them, but that Kaya and her baby are out there and Citizen Z is not with them and evidently on his way back. So we know from publicity photos that he's going to be in the show, when we don't know.
And looking pretty rough.
So we'll have to see when they finally pop up. Anastasia has been off for a little bit, thanks to Addie disappearing.
Yeah, and now they're not going in the direction of Numerica, and if Addie is,
yeah,
But also, Addie and Lucy have a bit of a connection too, so yeah. It's possible Addie would be able to find them. Because if Addie and Lucy have a connection and Lucy and Warren have a connection, does that mean Addie and Warren could also have a connection as well?
And then, as far as Warren's concerned, who also, by the way, gets to have one of the nice quips in the episode where she turns to Murphy at one point and says, "Why so blue?" Which was nice. She sees this white glove on her hand at one point, too, and she's been doing these weird hand movements. Obviously, we're heading towards some kind of thing that's going to involve her having to, like, I just feel like it's like she's been pre-programmed that she's going to have to, like, shut down some kind of reactor or turn on some kind of thing. Or it feels very video game-like, like she's going to have to do a thing with a thing. But I don't know what that's going
to
be.
That's the back of the video game box, by the way.
Do a thing with a thing?
You'll have to do a thing with a thing as you stop the guy from the stuff.
I always like to look for that to see whether the game has a lot to do. When I have to do a thing with a thing.
Yep.
Then I know it's going
to
be good.
Well, it seems to me that it kind of goes back to what I was talking about after that first episode where she wakes up there. Obviously, something was going on while she was in her coma. Whether it was her just absorbing information from being there or the fact that they were using her blood or waking her up a little bit at a time because they needed something from her. There's something that was going on, and she somehow has embedded in her memory at least a sliver of what their next move is, because she keeps seeing the fire and she's explaining to everyone about the visions that the fire consumes everyone, human and zombie alike, that it's going to burn you up. And we had had that glimpse in the first episode of the doctor experimenting on the zombie hand with some kind of reactive agent that burned it up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible that they're just going to wipe everything off the face of the earth except for whatever's protected from the substance they've created to do it. And if she doesn't stop them...
Oh, like a sort of like worldwide napalm.
Yeah. Which also feels very Resident Evil. I got Resident Evil on the brain, but that Zona is really becoming Umbrella Corp at this
point. We do have to watch the last Resident Evil movie, too. It's the only one we haven't seen yet. And I will say also, we've been talking about this off the show. It does seem, I have no inside information about this, so don't take anything as gospel, but it does seem like it's very possible this could be their last season. There seems to be a significant ramping up, particularly on social media, of them promoting the show in a way that feels a little different than it has in the past, as if to say, well, it could be they're really trying to get their numbers back up. If that's true, I wonder to what extent they might have planned for an ending of the season that could serve as a finale.
Mm-hmm.
And or at least an apocalyptic cliffhanger on a level they never did before, even though I truly hate when people who think they see the writing on the wall do the gambit of, well, we'll give them a cliffhanger because that'll make them bring us back. That's always a bad idea. It's hard to say where this is going, but it could be that Warren's storyline is heading to something truly big and potentially final. Even if they wind up coming back, it just feels like maybe they're preparing for that.
We went past the point a little while ago where man versus zombie was sort of the ultimate battle.
Right.
You know, they're going across the country, and for the most part, they really got to contend with disease and occasionally a small enclave of humans that set up their own society somehow. But now it really is this good versus evil, like the Stand human interaction that's going on. And in the middle of all of it, there's still zombies. There's these mutated zombies. They're posing more of an issue.
Well, like I said before several times about that other show I keep bringing up oddly, is that ultimately you do kind of get to that point. There's a certain point beyond which the simple structure of the zombie apocalypse, you have to grow beyond that in order to explore other issues about human nature and keep your plot going. It can't simply be that. Particularly if there's a built-in logic about how the zombies behave and how they eventually decay or cease to be a threat, then you have to have other things. And of course, the old trope about the real enemy or the other human beings, that's what you have to wind up doing.
Well, then I'm going to go ahead and go out on a limb and hypothesize how this all plays out. There has to be some kind of major confrontation between either Warren's group and Zona, or Warren and the rest of amassed civilization and Zona, sort of getting help from Numerica or whatever military outfit is left. And that ultimately, whatever is going to go down will do so in a way that does eradicate a good portion of the zombie threat and allow for them to set something up that, like, maybe Numerica, whatever it is, becomes sort of the starting point eventually for something new.
This is good.
And that'll do it for this episode of Doctor of the Dead. Find a complete archive of this show, along with many other podcasts, at itunes.com/G2V. Be sure to subscribe for the latest episodes, and if you like what you hear, rate and review. On Twitter, follow Arnold at Doctor of the Dead, and Natalie at NB Latovsky. Doctor of the Dead is a G2V and ATV Publishing production.